Good morning. We're back in business, at least for 24 hours, and hopefully no freezing rain to slow us down again. Open the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Today we have a good discussion of our property tax system, and I think the problem that we're going to use as entree into that discussion is this whole issue of federal timber receipts and the effect that's going to have on local governments across Oregon. So we'll start with kind of an update of that problem, and then turn it over to Mary and really get into the whole okay. property tax system if that structure works. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll have like a 15-20 minute discussion of just the federal timber issue and then go right into the property tax system. Before we do that, Paul, you have an answer for us on a question or two that came up at our hearing on Martin Luther King Day.
Okay, Mr. Chair, as you recall, the Monday meeting I was given some homework. And the question was the general fund lottery budget and overall expenditures and how the potential 0709 increase would compare with the legislatively approved budget of 0103. And what I did was I took the general fund lottery budget of $11.97 billion, so just a little short of $12 billion in 0103, and looked at the 0709 revenue projection, which is about $15.1 billion. I subtracted out the, it's about $1.53 billion. I subtracted out the Education Stability Fund and a projected ending balance of $150 million, and I came up with about $14.9 billion, which would be the 19.5% increase we had talked about during the committee meeting. Compared that with the 11.9 from 0103, which I assumed a 4% annual growth rate, which fiscal office told me it was way too low based on growth of public safety spending and other types of expenditures. But give you a sense, on a 4% annual growth, or about 8.2% per biennium, you would have had, for 0709, needed about $15.15 billion in revenue to match that 0103 level. That's a difference of about $255 million. In other words, we'd be about $255 million short of that 0103 approved budget level, assuming a 4% annual rate of inflation since then. So we're still short of getting back to that level.
So
even under pretty conservative assumptions.
So it would be accurate to say we do the big 19% or 19.whatever% increase this biennium, we still would not be spending more than we did in that 0103 with the approved budget that we had prior to the special sessions and the cuts.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Paul just on that issue from our hearing on Monday. Okay, here we go. So big emerging issue, this federal timber receipts, and Gil from the counties can talk to us about the problem, and I think there's a lot of curiosity of any prospects in Congress for a one-year or a permanent continuation of this program.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Policy Manager, Association of Oregon Counties. Before I begin my remarks, I'd like to point out that there are four assessors who made the trip here because of their interest in this. Richard Kreitzer, Marion County; Doug Hillpott, Benton County; Mike Schneider, Josephine County, which is ground zero on this issue; and David Lawson, Yamhill County. They're in the audience. We have a serious problem in public service finance, and it's collective. And the reason why it's collective because it affects both state government and county governments. There's no single solution. Counties can't solve this on their own, and the state cannot solve it on its own. So this is a joint, collective problem. My role today is to describe the problem to you with enough nuance to present the complexity of it, but I will try not to burden you with data. I'll give you enough data so that you appreciate that there's further work that needs to be done. One reason why it's a collective problem is because of the role that counties play in delivery and policy, delivery of shared services. And that's illustrated by this color table. And you see the red, the listed red services are those that are done jointly by the state and counties. If counties cannot perform these services, the state will have to decide whether the services will continue. The services run the gamut of public safety and health and support to schools and the like. The data that I'm going to point out is on this next table titled Complexity of Impacts to Oregon Counties from the Loss of PL 106393, and I'll walk you through that a little bit. And I apologize for the font. It's quite small, but I wanted to keep it on one page. As you know, the Federal Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000 has expired. And with it, counties have lost $200 million a year in revenues, and the state school system has lost $62 million a biennium. You'll find the losses to general funds by county in the column titled Revenue Loss to County General Funds without PL 106393, and that's toward the right. It's just to the left, column just to the left of the first colored column. Let me give a context briefly. The state suffered its most severe drop in general fund revenues in the 2001-2003 biennium since the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. If you had not exercised your borrowing authority and other mitigating measures, your loss would have been 13%. Look at the bottom of that column. The loss to all 36 counties of their annual general fund revenues amounts to 12.3% in the column next to it. Now, I hesitate to do this because I know the makeup of the committee, but if you remove Washington and Multnomah counties, not to minimize the hit on those two counties, from this list, that loss, percentage loss of annual general fund discretionary revenues swells to 20%. In the other 34 counties, that's 20% per year. And I also want to note that there are six counties that are losing over one-third of their discretionary revenue. The majority of county spending is in public safety. So these cuts will damage public safety in Oregon and wound public health and community livability. By the same token, the losses to road funds by county is just as startling. You look at the last column, and you can see that the annual road fund revenues lost to counties statewide is nearly 20%, and that 11 counties will lose more than 40% of their annual road revenues. The counties with the most significant road losses are in no position to backfill with general funds. They simply do not have the general funds available. So clearly, counties can't be a full partner in the state transportation system. Now, what about the county's major source of revenue, the property tax system? Well, the expiration of secure rural schools has exposed some structural handcuffs in Oregon's public finance system. First, Measure 50 cut property taxes and then froze them. They're permanent. So you can note the permanent rates in the column titled Permanent Rate Authority, and that's the fourth column from the left. Notice, for example, Josephine County's frozen rate is 59 cents a thousand taxable value. Curry County's is less than 60 cents. The median rate for county government is a modest $2.58. One effect of these modest rates is that counties simply cannot grow out of the problem. Let's take Curry County as a stark example. Curry County has 12,000 homes with a median assessed value of $225,000. In order to replace their general fund losses, Curry County would have to add 33,000 new homes. That's almost three times what they have now, at an assessed value of $350,000 each, which is well above their current median assessed value. Moreover, these counties that are many of these same counties are dominated by public land, so their areas to tax and to grow are limited. You'll notice in the column percent of state and federal ownership, which is right about the center of the general fund series of columns, that there are 18 counties, that is half of the counties in Oregon, are owned, publicly owned, by more than 40%. They simply don't have the ability to grow out of this. Adding to the complications is the property change ratio, Under Measure 50 in the Oregon Constitution, new construction is put on the tax roll, not at its full value. And I'm told that this is a big surprise to newly arrived Californians. But what happens instead? What happens instead is that a county CPR is applied to the real market value, and that's a factor that's determined by the average maximum assessed value of that class of property in the county in the numerator, and the average real market value of that class of property in the county in the denominator. That ratio is applied to the real market value. And you see those property, those change property ratios in the column, the fifth column from the left, residential change property ratio. Now, there are eight categories, and residential is the prominent one. So how does that operate? As an example, in Coos County, a new home sold for $300,000. It would go on the tax roll at a maximum assessed value of $184,200. Apply the county's permanent rate of $1.08, and that new home generates merely $199 a year for an array of county public services, primarily public safety and health, that benefits the property and the owners of that property. There is a modest tool available under current law, the local option property tax levy. However, it's temporary, limited to 5 years, and it's subject to Measure 5 compression. Voters must approve it, and it's subject to the standard double majority requirements. Nevertheless, in fiscal year 06, we had eight counties that were successful in carrying local option levies to minimize the cuts that they had to impose. These local option levies amount to nearly $81 million, and they're included in the column Property taxes to counties excluding bonds, which is the sixth column from the left. Mm-hmm. Now, that $81 million may not be renewed by the voters, so that may be subtracted from the total. So I'll close my remarks by just noting three examples of immediate and painful cuts counties are considering. Coos County is preparing to lay off a quarter of its 400-plus workforce.
When?
They're in the beginning budget process now. And there are counties that are doing dual budgets, just in case, and I'll get to your second question in a moment. Hope is diminishing, and in any event, if there's a delay in reauthorization or any kind of money coming from federal government, then these are going to have to be imposed. Curry County is considering laying off all of its sheriff's patrol and declaring bankruptcy. Jackson County, as a beginning measure, is closing its 15 libraries. There are no easy answers, and Mr. Chair, to get to your question, there's a concerted effort. We have been involved for the last 4 or 5 years in Congress. We've devoted manpower and resources to reauthorize PL 106393. The way it's looking now, there is a bill that would do that on a seven-year basis, H.R. 17 in the House, and it's co-sponsored by Congressman DeFazio and Walden. They are working very, very hard, and they have key members as co-sponsors. The problem appears to be in the Senate. We did not get it when the Republicans were in control, and Senator Wyden has been shopping a proposal to his caucus, and my understanding that the majority leader has said he's going to have to hear from other senators and a number of other senators before he's going to consider it. So a fallback is a one-year. The opportunity may lie in a continuing resolution, emergency resolution, attach it to the funding to Iraq. The problem the last couple of years throughout has been, what is the offset? They're now in a pay-as-you-go budget authorization process. And Senator Wyden, with Senator Baucus, has offered an offset that was rejected. It had to do with the withholding money for government contractors, and it received some fierce opposition from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Did not pass last time. All we can do, we're continuing to work, and we're continuing to go back there and do what we can. But it frankly, one is beginning to lose hope. So this is our situation.
So, Gail, if you had to put it in a 1 and 10, both the 1 year and then the 7 year, and I know this is predicting the behavior of Congress is probably as tough to then predict what's going to happen here in Salem, but do you have any, could you make a best guess for us or a best estimate for us in terms of what you're hearing? And maybe we'll ask folks in the audience just after you if they have better, if they have other reads on what Congress might do.
Jeez. I think that we're seeing good movement in the House. There's very good potential in the House. If that creates some momentum, then I think that will certainly help senators. If it has to start in the Senate, I think it's dead. I understand that Oregon gets 54% of this money. The reason for that is because we have fed the Treasury to that extent from our federal forests over time. So it's perfectly rational and legitimate. But you're a senator from Connecticut, and you're wondering, here's this big program, $500 million a year. Well, big to us, small to them, but it's still a program. They're spending their money. Why does Oregon get 54% of that money? So that's another issue that we've had to deal with. We are, of course, prepared to take a little less. But we're waiting to see. We're waiting for the appropriate signals and waiting to see what we can do.
Questions for Mr. Riddell? Yeah, Senator.
Yeah, just refresh my memory about when did this particular federal funding start, and give me a little bit more background.
Okay.
I'm familiar, but it's maybe a little foggy.
Sure. Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, there was a major change in management of the federal forests in the end of the 80s having to do with endangered species issues.
Mm-hmm.
The result was a lawsuit that was successful out of a district court in Washington State that basically closed down the forests until there was a plan to deal with the spotted owl. President Clinton developed a plan, a Northwest Forest Plan, and that included thanks to Senator Hatfield and Representative Coyne, it included a safety net provision for counties in Western Washington, Western Oregon, and Northern California, and some economic development measures that were very, very helpful. The plan has not been implemented the way it was intended. Lawsuits have successfully prevented the ability of the plan to deliver a certain level of forest products. There was an additional safety net, and then in 2000, there was a budget surplus in Congress, and the stars were aligned, and we were able to have this safety net expand nationwide. And it's based on the highest 3 years period of revenues that received by a county, and so this is a national safety net program, and now it benefits Eastern Oregon, primarily road funds in Eastern Oregon, and continues in Western Oregon. It costs the federal government about $500 million a year. Oregon receives about $240 million of that, and it was set to expire in 2006, and it did. It ran for 6 years. The expiration, however, is viewed differently by different people. Senator Wyden will tell you this was just a temporary stop to review it, and he expects this. He would like to see this as a permanent program. He thinks it would be fair to be a permanent program. The majority, however, school of thought is that this is temporary. It should be longer than 6 years, but that there are other measures that are being proposed, and the ONC Counties Association has done that, a proposal measure that would fund it fund the program nationwide with a redirection of some revenues and some different management of the OMC forests. The difficulty is these are national lands, and whereas the ONC forests had some direction of leading use being timber harvest, the national forest does not have that. So it has been managed over time based on the preference of the public at the time. And that brings us to today. We have very low timber harvest. The infrastructure has gradually eroded to the point where it's pretty meager, and the Northwest Forest Plan is still not delivering what the original promise was, and now we don't have the support of the safety net revenues.
Thank you. I appreciate that kind of bigger picture background.
Thank you, Gail. Would anyone else, and particularly the assessors who've traveled, but anyone else like to address this topic? We're going to, in terms of our agenda, we won't return to this issue. At least it's not scheduled for at least a month out. So particularly the assessors who've traveled a great distance in tough weather, but anyone like to address this issue for us? Yes, sir. Please. Somehow I knew this was our assessors. I don't know how, but I just guessed that was our assessors in the audience.
Chairman Decker, Senator Starr Monroe, thank you for giving me a chance. Josephine County's effects, if you've looked at Gil's charts.
We just need to have you identify yourself.
I'm Mike Schneider. I'm the Josephine County Assessor. I've been the Josephine County Assessor for 6 years. The effects to Josephine County are going to be tremendous if we truly use these OMC funds. If you look at Gil's chart, it's someplace above 68% of our discretionary funds. We are starting through a series of meetings to determine the effects to our county if that happens. Our commissioners have already said that we would have to lay off our entire sheriff's department except for the mandated jail service in the civil deputy. We have had a very reduced assessor or sheriff's office for a substantial period of time. They are telling me that I will lose in the neighborhood of 1 to 2 employees. And I have ran a very, very thrifty office. I received letters from the Oregon Department of Revenue explaining that generally at the various reports that we have to submit each year that I cannot fall below the level that I'm at now. And the commissioners are still looking at reducing my staff possibly up to 2 people. This situation for our county is one where we are wringing our hands, really trying to determine how we will continue as a county. It is that bad. We're in the same situation as Curry. But that's if you have any specific questions, I'd like to answer those.
Just wondering, and thank you very much for being here this morning. Just wondering, has discussions begun in Josephine County or other counties? And you're right, you're highlighted in the red here, of possible steps absent congressional action, possible steps that Josephine or other counties might take.
We are considering a local option tax in our county. The local option tax would be if we were going to only backfill the lost ONC funds, would be a property tax with a rate of about $2.42 a thousand. And we would have to pass that in this year in either a May or September election. As you know, those elections require the 50-50 majority. Typically, in a non-election year like we have this year, our turnout for a May election is about 28 or 29%. We would need more than 50% turnout, and we would have to have the people of the county vote for an increase of $2.42 a thousand to backfill that.
Yeah. So Paul's pointing out to me, we do have a double majority issue bill in committee, and so that's something that we actually, school capital, and that's part of the school capital conversation, is on our docket for early February. That won't help you immediately, though, because that will be a longer discussion. But it is something that Paul points out.
That would have to be effective for the May election or September election if we fail in the May election.
Yeah. Yeah, Senator Stark.
This is money not for this current budget, but for your next fiscal year, correct? I mean, so between now, you're talking about fiscal year starting July 1, right?
Starting July 1. We are looking at cuts between now and July 1. We're calling it to soften our landing. We are looking at cuts in the present budget.
And my understanding is you've received your last check. Hopefully not. I shouldn't say last check. Under this current regime, the last, but hopefully Congress will catch up with soon. That was my understanding. I think Gil or someone had informed me that at least the last check had been sent from this current.
Yes, Chairman.
Well, thank you very much. Like I said, we are keeping our eye on and certainly understand the gravity of the decisions and the issues that you face, and appreciate you coming and letting us know what's happening in Josephine County.
Thank you, Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I have a question, I think, maybe for Paul. I mean,
could you just stay just in case?
A county declaring bankruptcy. What does that process look like? I mean, talk through that maybe if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, Senator, there are certain functions that the state would be responsible for, such as the property tax system. It's a state-administered system. So there would be some state, there'd have to be a state role to maintain that in some way. There's also, in the public safety area, we've had discussions around community corrections and the option of the state taking over those kind of functions. So I would anticipate, if indeed we got to this point, we would see the state having to expand its role in that county, and we'd probably have to look at various financing means to try to pull the county out of that situation. I don't believe we haven't had any extended period like this, in the post-war period. We had that occur in the 30s, where we had a number of local governments throughout the country which were in that situation.
So, Paul, and you may want to jump in on this. I'm looking at the permanent rate for Josephine County, and it's about 58. So I'm not seeing one that's lower. Curry seems relatively close at 59 cents. You go all the way to Sherman, and it's $8.70 in terms of the permanent rate. That would, to do anything on those, my understanding, it would take state action. But am I wrong on that? Mary, you might even get into this in your presentation.
Mr. Chair, the permanent rates would have to be changed through the Constitution. Those are the permanent rates from Measure 50. The county can go above that for local option, and Mike was talking about that as a possibility. Of course, the county is constrained by Measure 5, so it can go above the Measure 50 rate, but it's still limited by the Measure 5 rate. If the state were to come in and impose a property tax, say for shared revenue on a statewide basis, the state is required to have a uniform rate or some uniformity in that statewide property tax. And that's something we have talked a little bit about. But that means that you would have these, widely different rates. You'd have a state rate on top of that.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator Monroe.
Thank you. Counties
are instruments of the state. They were created by the state and given certain responsibilities by the state. They're unlike cities, which have home rule authority. So we, the state legislature, state government, does have a responsibility, direct responsibility for this problem. And if Congress doesn't see fit to extend or to assist us, then something rather revolutionary will probably have to take place, like a statewide property tax or something else. And, of course, they're talking about eliminating the sheriff's office, or so significantly reducing it that it virtually doesn't exist. They already have, my aunt lives in your county, and I get down there quite a bit, and they already have very little sheriff's service in the city that she lives in, which is Cave Junction, virtually non-existent. And at a time when, of course, we're talking about the fact that we have less than half as many state troopers as we had on the road 25 years ago, so which compounds the problem, makes it virtually impossible, unless we fix that problem, for the state to help backfill for law enforcement in some of these counties. This is a major crisis. I appreciate you coming up to talk to us today. We cannot ignore this. We must deal with this situation, because the counties are instruments of the state, created by the state, and we're responsible for them.
Do you want to disagree with that? Again, thank you. We really do appreciate it. It's helpful to get the on-the-ground update from a county that's probably affected about as much as any county in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Chairman. Senator Monroe, Senator Stark.
Anyone else on the, before we move on to the larger issue of property taxes in Oregon, we have someone making his way, an old friend to this committee.
Good morning, Chairman Deckard, Senator Monroe, Senator Starr. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you. Senator Starr, I appreciate the question you asked a little bit ago. For the record, my name is Bill Kluding. I represent the Carpenters Industrial Council. Most of my members are in these rural areas where this money is going to go away. What mills we have left, we're barely hanging on to. When this program was started, this state was about as low as we could get as far as industry in our forests. Luckily, at the time, our government had almost a $1 trillion surplus. But as hard as this program was to get, I can show you where this money comes out of appropriations. 5 minutes to go before the deadline of all final activities coming out of appropriations to be approved at that session of Congress. 5 minutes to go with a $1 trillion budget profit. They allowed this to come through. The chairman of appropriations finally agreed and took it to the next step. And this is how Oregon wound up with this money. Today, we do not have that surplus. We're almost the exact opposite. Last session, I went around and started emphasizing the fact that this money was going to go away. I hand-delivered to each one of you this little paper right here. It shows exactly the amount of money each county is not going to get. When you talk to the people, Oregon doesn't have much clout back in D.C. There's 100 senators, but we only have two. California almost has 50 more representatives than we do. And when appropriations sets down and starts looking at who gets what money, I think Oregon is going to be way, way down the list. Hopefully, the best I see and the experts you talk to, even Even Senator Wyden, I approached him just 2 weeks ago. He's hoping that we can get a partial one-year extension. But when that comes along, I don't know. These counties can't wait. When their money runs out, they're out. Hopefully, both of these chambers look at the idea of putting something together to give to our senators and representatives to reintroduce the idea and the thought of kicking in President Clinton's Northwest Forest Plan. That was a good plan. The benefit was there for everybody. I worked somewhat with Jack Ward Thomas when he put his spotted owl report. I've been involved in these timber issues for almost 30 years. Jack Ward Thomas will admit one thing that was wrong with his owl plan. They forgot to designate how many millions of acres there is in the Northwest that we could go ahead and sustainable log to keep these counties going. He said that's the only mistake we made when we put the owl plan together. I appreciate your time, and I'll try to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, you just, from my perspective, you just hit the nail on the head about the fact of the matter is the only reason we got our hand out to Washington is because we can't cut the trees that we used to cut. You talked about getting the Northwest Forest Plan reengaged. What's the process to get that done from your perspective?
It'll be easy to get it back in the process. Where it gets tied up is in the courts or a threat of a lawsuit. We've spent years and years working with the mainstream environmental groups, and most of them today will admit that they went too far. They didn't realize it was going to go this far. We have millions and millions of acres in our national forests that right now are in Category 3, Category 2 fire danger. We have vast stands of timber that are overgrown, too thick, but yet our mills are still going down. All it takes is a threat of a lawsuit. Our national forest directors, our forest managers, were hand-tied to the point that frankly, they're doing nothing today. I know that's not a very good answer, Senator Starr, but that's my perspective. Somehow these court systems are going to have to be fine-tuned to where one or two person can stop a timber sale or a thinning sale. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anyone else on the federal timber receipts issue before we go broader into the Mary Aiella?
I'll probably deal with the forest issue a little bit.
Sure. So folks know Mary is our, not new any longer, she's been with us, 3 years, 4 years, came from Florida. Yes. We always lament our snowy, rainy weather in the winter when we see Mary in January, yeah. But she's our property tax expert and economist for the legislature, and will walk us through this issue.
Chair Deckard, and other members of the committee that are here. Can you hear me all right?
Speak up a little bit.
Maybe. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. This morning I'd like to present an overview to you of Oregon's property taxes and federal forest revenues that are two important local concerns. My presentation will provide you with some general background about property taxes, assessed values based on constitutional changes that were adopted in 1990 and 97. It'll also rank some Oregon's property taxes so that you can see how they stack up with other states. And then I'll finally conclude Section 1 by giving you some background material on those federal timber revenues so that you know how this evolved now that it's gone, but at least we know how it evolved. Part 2 will cover the more detailed aspects of the presentation because it will get into the property tax rate structure. I'll be talking about how this structure has been created to really ensure that property taxes are used for specific purposes. And there's some downsides to that, which I'll point out. But basically, I think that was one of the reasons the structure is set up that way. And then I'll finish up with an overview of the federal forest revenues and property taxes to show how they vary by region within the state. And sometimes getting down into the detailed regional level shows you some very big differences that are important to understand. At the aggregate level, you sort of miss those details. Okay. Property that's taxed in the state, property tax usually consists mainly of real property and personal property. Real property includes land itself and buildings. Personal property, of course, includes movable possessions and merchandise, furniture, etc. Some intangible property in the state is actually taxed by the Department of Revenue, but there's an exemption right now of about, I think, $8 billion a year on intangibles valued. The department values them at over $350 billion, I believe. But the department performs assessments on certain types of property, which allows it to tax using a unitary approach, which doesn't distinguish between intangibles and tangibles. And so when it taxes central utilities and industrial property valued over $1 million, it doesn't tax, in fact, some intangibles. Currently, telephone, landline, but not cable companies are taxed through the Department of Revenue as central assessed property. In either 2008 or 2009, however, according to the August 2006 presentation that the Department of Revenue presented to the Senate, or the House, actually, Interim Committee, the department's updated its interpretation of communication services and intends to include cable and Internet service providers under their central assessment. As such, it will begin to assess them in 2008 and 2009. And the importance of this, I think, worth noting, is that, as such, cable and Internet providers will be taxed using the unitary approach, which means its intangibles will be taxed. And currently, the local assessors will tax these companies, and they're not able to tax intangibles. So this might become an issue.
And it's going to be, because the cable companies have all called. They don't like it. So now... A county, I'll pick mine, Washington, would start through the intangible tax, would have access to the intangible and the centrally assessed.
The Department of Revenue will begin taxing the cable companies. And as such, they do not distinguish between intangible and intangible property. They use a unitary approach, an income approach. So it will shift. It will shift the responsibility of the Department of Revenue. They will tax unitarily. And that means the intangibles will now be subject to tax.
Uh-huh.
If it's stayed in Washington County, the local assessors can only tax they cannot tax intangibles.
They have to
develop an approach to exclude that. And, of course, in certain states, intangibles are not subject to tax. You know, but in this state, there's this variation there.
Huh.
Okay. This... graph basically shows you how property taxes, the red bars, have increased from about $800 per person to about $1,100 per person in FY05-06. The change translates into a growth rate of about 3.5% per year. Basically, the property tax growth has kept pace with income growth, which is why from 1996-97 forward, the ratio of property tax to personal income has remained about 3% per year, as denoted by that flat blue line. Looking at other western states in FY05-06, the property tax share of personal income also appears to be about 3% in California, Washington, and Idaho. However, these three states actually approached their 3% from lower historical rates, and Oregon has approached it from above. This particular table is intended to show you how Oregon ranks with respect to other states. With respect to the blue line, or the blue bars, Oregon ranked 28 in FY99-00 and 26 in FY03-04. which indicates that over this period of time, taxes as a percent of increased relative to other states. In actual dollars, however, in the red line, you'll see per capita income as denoted before at $800, moving up to $1,100 in FY03-04. It shows that our ranking has actually improved. This means that in FY01-02, an Oregonian was paying less property tax than persons in 22 other states, and by FY03-04, it was paying less property tax than about 30 other states. By district, you can see that education, of course, absorbs 46% of about $3.7 billion in property tax revenues. It's an enormous revenue source for all of the 1,500 or so taxing districts in the state. High growth in real market values, especially in real residential property, plus a lot of new construction covered that occurred over the last 2 or 3 years, enabled many local districts to increase their property tax revenues. Among them, you can see special districts were able to increase their rates by 7.63%, counties by 4.5%. However, the important thing to keep in mind is that growth of 4% or 5% does not mean that services are necessarily going to be maintained at previous levels. If service requirements and new construction increased by 5 or 6% or inflation increased, the cost of providing services. Another factor to keep in mind is that statewide average growth rates do not reflect the financial condition of specific local districts. The more dependent the districts are on property taxes, the less they are able to deal with the rate compression that I'll talk about in a little while. Especially if this rate compression is a long-term situation, as discussed in, and we'll discuss that shortly. The federal timber revenues are another major issue that you've just heard about from Gil Riddell, but I'll give you a little background on it. In 1908, the federal government dedicated 25% of all revenues from the management of two land grants, totaling about 2.5 million acres, dedicated the lands to government services, public schools, and rural schools. In 1937, the federal government granted counties the revenues from the sale of timber on these lands in perpetuity. During 1990, the federal forest revenues began to decline due to a change in management practices. I believe there were some conservation efforts that Congress was interested in. But it did guarantee minimum federal foreign payments to continue until September 2006. Here's basically just an overview of what counties obtained in FY05-06, which would be an estimate of what they will lose, or they will lose because of this elimination of these payments. You can see from this table about one-third of $228 million would have been going to road construction. A little less than half will impact general funds, and the balance will be impacting school funding. And the degree to which losses affect local district, again, depends on their reliance on these sources. If you get down to the local level. A summary here for this section, major points, I guess, that we know what the level of property taxes are, $3.76 billion. It's growing pretty much comparable with other states at 3% per year. I mean, as a percentage of income. The districts, largely education, gets 46%. The counties and cities get less. But again, the important thing to recall is what portion of the total local revenue base depends on property taxes. That's really the more important of the issues. Some taxes are, for example, more dependent on property taxes and timber revenues than other districts. Therefore, they have major concerns when rate compression becomes a long-term constraint on their property tax growth and when these federal forest revenues are no longer paid. Get into the second part of this presentation. We'll deal with a little more detail about these issues, and some of it we may want to jump through because the federal forest timber revenues are actually were actually well presented earlier. But I can tell you a little bit more about Measures 5 and 50 and how that affects local tax revenues. The tax originally for Measure 5 was a constitutional amendment enacted by voter initiative in 1990, and it sets the limit on property taxes at $5 per thousand for real market value on school districts and $10 per thousand real market value for the non-school districts. The rate limits were imposed on real market value. It wasn't until 1997 that Measure 50 actually constructed a new tax base, which was assessed value as opposed to real market value. The rate structure, I call it a rate structure because it, some tax, because there are components to the rate structure, the major one being the permanent rate, which was set back in 1997-98, and I'll explain the formula for that shortly, some of which, as Gil Riddell pointed out, was set up lower than they normally would have been had the timber revenues not been there for those jurisdictions. Some taxing districts had the authority to use all of these components of the structure, and they're used for different purposes. There's an error here on this. I just wanted to make you aware of it. I've labeled Urban Renewal Special Levy at $123 million. That is actually the urban renewal component of the, let's say, permanent rate that's pulled out through what's called division of tax. So that should be, that is mislabeled. That should just be urban renewal division of tax or taxes from division of tax. There was an additional $33 million in special levies, actually. The permanent rate was calculated back in 1997-98. It's required by Measure 50, and it was based on this formula. As you can see, the assessed value in 1970 for each property would have been set equal to its 95-96 value, which was real market value, less 10%. And the rollback levy, I call it, was the amount that was the taxing authority in 1997-98, less 17%. You put those things together in a ratio, and you get the permanent rate. It's a constructed rate that was that hasn't changed. Okay. The other components of the tax rate structure, as I call it, consist of the general obligation bonds, which are used to repay indebtedness for long-term capital projects. It requires voter approval by that double majority. The gap bond levies were used to repay indebtedness that could not be rolled up into the permanent rate levies. The local option taxes, which have a duration of 5 or 10 years for different, for, I think the 5-year ones are for the short-term projects, the 10-year ones are for the longer-term capital improvements, and they also have to be approved by the double majority. Urban renewal indebtedness, a property tax is used to repay indebtedness on bonds issued by the agencies, your agencies, as part of what's called tax increments financing.
Do you know what percentage of that, I know you might, we went through this whole urban renewal exercise last session, what percentage of that indebtedness is in Multnomah County?
What is the indebtedness level?
What is the, of the whole state, that $133 million rough figure, how much of that is Multnomah? What percentage of that?
I do not have the data, but I'll find it for you.
Great.
Most of it.
Yeah.
Okay. It's probably a very large share. Okay.
Yeah. It'd just be interesting to know, is it 70%?
I had some data on that for 2003-04, and I just couldn't update it for this presentation. I couldn't get the source for the update, but I have a listing that goes back to
2003-04. Yeah, if you have that 2003-04 numbers, it'd be interesting to know how much.
Mm-hmm. I'd be glad to do that. The simplest explanation that I can give you for why these rates were constructed the way they were, and as a what I call a rate structure, is that, as opposed to just summing them up, is that Measure 5's constitutional limit, if it's exceeded for some reason or another, the taxing authorities have to lower their rates, but they have to do it in a certain order. The local option taxes, for example, would have to be compressed first, then the other the other rates. And so the permanent rate would be the last one to go. But that's why you just can't construct a single rate as opposed to keeping these things separate. Although it's on your bill, you might think of it as a single rate. I wanted to give you an example of what occurs when rates have to be compressed because it shows the interdependence of the taxing districts. They're not autonomous. They can't just know in any one year exactly how much they're going to get from raising what I call extending a rate. They can extend a rate, say, I want to impose this much. This is how much we're going to need. But when it goes through this process of determining how much they're actually going to get, it all depends on the process I'm going to describe now, based on the fact that each taxing district is one of several districts that provides services to a single property. Okay, a code area is defined for all properties within a certain geographic area that are served by the same set of taxing districts. Each taxing district could independently extend or say, I need this much rate to provide a certain number of services, right, to my service community. It extends the rate. The tax assessor will sum up those rates sorted into whether it's a non-school activity or a school activity, because Measure 5 has two different rates, the $5 and the $10 limits. Okay, when this, I call it the composite rate, is pulled together, if it exceeds the M5 limits, it's going to have to be compressed. The rate's going to be have to be compressed. Now, in this example, for example, suppose all of, let's say I add up these rates and it equals the $10 limit. Suppose the city of Baker had more taxing authority. Suppose it had not been using its permanent rate and it decided that it wanted to impose or extend, use the full permanent rate authority, and it decided it wanted to extend a $7.6 rate. Let's say that's its full authority. Well, now you're over the M5 limit, right? At that point, the compression kicks in, and the extra dollar isn't taken out entirely from, it's taken out in proportion to those proportions that you see here on the graph. And so sitting in Baker County, right, it might not have to do anything that year. It might have it might have the same rate that it had the year before. It might have the same service requirements, but based on the interdependence among the other taxing districts within the code area, it would end up with a compressed rate. Okay? That's one of the problems with the compression. And if you are in a county where you are highly dependent on property taxes as a source of income, and if you're already in compression, all right, this becomes more of a difficult issue for you. Now, by 1997, Measure 50 was enacted or adopted by voters, ballot, and the intent of this was to put a cap on the growth in assessed value, because after Measure 5 was passed, rates declined from what had been maybe $25 per thousand real market value. Over a phase-in period, it dropped down to the 15. Okay, but real property values were rising over the period after 1990 started rising. And so from the taxpayer's perspective, taxes were rising in excess of what they thought it should be. And so they adopted Measure 50, put a cap on growth in AV, and they constructed a measure for assessed value as well, which is rather interesting. The measure, as I said earlier, was defined as property values AV is 1995-96 real market value less 10%. So it really rolled back what the assessed value was, separate from what real market value was. And then it was going to be computed thereafter. And the computation formula for that, I have errors, I think, on your handout, where I have highlighted them in green. I think what you're looking at might say 103% of MAV, and it really should be AV there. And the formula is basically, you use the original calculation for maximum assessed value that we just looked at, the rollback rate, and from that period forward, you use this formula, which is either the greater of prior year's AV, or rather 100% of prior year's MAV, or 103% of prior year's AV plus exception value times the CPR. Exception value is something like new construction. I have a home and I add on an addition that has an extra value. I multiply that by the county's change percent ratio, which Gil mentioned earlier is the ratio of the county's assessed value to its real property value. Get that value and I compare it, make a comparison, take the greater of those two amounts, and then come down to the second step and say it, but can never be greater than RMV, real market value. Here's an example to show you how it works. Let's say your prior year MAV was $89,000. You have to take the greater of that value or the second value, which is your prior year assessed value times 103%, which equals $90,000, plus exception value times the CPR, which say that equals $10,000. Add those two together, you've got $100,000 roughly. Take the greater of those two amounts, and that's your MAV for 2005 per property. And then you compare that to the property's real market value and take the lesser of the two. And that's how assessed value is computed every year. Now, if real market value is really growing fast relative to this formula, it's less likely that you're going to hit a compression. Okay. The problem is that if real market value is flat or declining, which can happen in certain cases, then compression is more likely to occur. This just basically describes what we were talking about earlier. Here, at this point, right here, where I've shown... Wait, I'm sorry. Backspace. Here, right here, you can see in 1990 where the M5, Measure 5, was adopted, and the rates fell from, I can put a pointer here, from almost 25 down to 15, and it's been at that rate ever since, really, subject to Measure 5 conditions. And you can see here in 1997, where Measure 50 was adopted, that's where you see the split between real market value and assessed value with the blue lines. And, of course, aggregate level kind of distorts the picture, because if you get down to local levels, you're going to see some differences. Okay. Compression losses by state at the statewide level, okay, don't appear to be a major issue, except in terms of dollars relative to the total amount collected, but they vary by jurisdiction. Okay. For example, let's see. In the Northeast, for example, the Northeast experienced higher compression rates than the statewide average, which happens to be 1.4% out of that $3.75 billion that were collected in taxes. Losses for counties were about $12.9 million, which is about 1.8%. But in some of the other districts at the county level in the Northeast, the rates might have been as high as 8%. Okay. Second, some county districts located in the western and southwestern parts of the state have not experienced compression yet, but with certainty, based on the conversation of the discussion you had earlier, they will be losing their forest revenues, and as such, it's virtually impossible for them not to have compression based on those arbitrarily determined permanent rates that were set back in 1997 when they had the forest revenues. So they will be faced with compression. This table really brings the property tax and forest revenues together into perspective by placing them in a single chart with other revenue sources for each county district. At this level, I think it's visually possible to appreciate the importance of some revenues relative to others. For example, here in eastern Oregon, among 13 counties, the highest bars are property taxes, with the exception of Grant, Wheeler, Harney, and Lake counties. In the northwest, among the 17 counties there, the property tax bars exceed all of the other bars, indicating the relative importance of this tax source. However, Lane, Linn, and Hood counties relied on federal forest payments for about 30% of their revenues. In the southwest, the 6 county taxing districts are highly dependent on forest revenues. Curry, Douglas, Josephine, Jackson, they all obtained about half their local revenues from these payments. Klamath and Coos counties obtained over 40% of their local revenues from these payments, and Jackson received about 30%. In terms of actual dollars, based on 03-04 data, we put some more current data together, but you can see that most of the losses occur in western Oregon. And you can see actual dollars here based on some FY05-06 data that Gilbert Riddell had given me earlier. And you can see what the importance of payments are relative to property taxes. Baker and Cook counties are more dependent on property taxes. As such, they're going to be more concerned about compression. Okay. However, they still stand to lose about $4.3 million in forest revenues. Overall, 5 counties in the northeast will lose about $20 million, or 10% of the statewide revenue loss from forest service, from forest revenues. In western Oregon, all but Lane County are located geographically in the southwest. However, it lies directly north of Douglas County. And these 5 counties will lose about $136 million, or 59% of that estimated $228 million in 05-06. The losses are astonishing if we compare them to other major sources of revenue. For example, across these 5 counties in FY05-06, the $77 million loss would have to double in order to offset. The property taxes would have to double in order to offset that losses. For Douglas County, property taxes would have to increase 700% in order to do that. I had some conclusions for you. Just summarizing this section first, some policy recommendations. Measure 5, just in summary, adopted or imposed $5 and $10 limits on school and non-school districts. Measure 5 brought statewide average tax rate down from about $20 per real market value to about $15. Measure 50, enacted in 1997, imposed limits on growth in assessed value, that's constructed value, from henceforth. And as of the end of 05-06, total AV in the state was about $250 million, 69% of real market value. Compression of the tax rates occur if the Measure 5 limits are exceeded. In FY05-06, a compression rate of 1.4%, or $52 billion, did not appear to be a large amount in relative terms. However, higher compression rates exist locally for some taxing districts. And if these rates persist over time, a taxing district loses its ability to maintain services even if voters approve a local option levy by a double majority, which is very difficult to do. A local study was done. I think the League of Oregon Cities did a study 3 years ago highlighting how difficult it was to get those kinds of local options passed. The loss of federal forest revenues will create a major crisis for several county districts in the current year. In several counties, the federal revenues in 05-06 were substantially greater than their property tax revenues, and it would be impossible to recoup those losses by raising property taxes because the permanent rates are that low. Given this background on some of the unique aspects of Oregon's property tax system, some issues that are not evident in other states are emerging concerns in Oregon. A narrow gap between RMV and AV values raises the likelihoods that rates will be compressed. As noted previously, compression rates already vary dramatically in Oregon by region and type of district. The interdependence of the taxing districts serving within a common code area will be a second source of compression. That is, some taxing districts could be compressed simply because their districts serving the same code area raised their rates to their maximum authority. The importance of the rate compression issue to taxing district really depends upon the degree to which it depends on property taxes as a source of funding. For example, absence of forest revenues for western and southwestern county districts will elevate property taxes to the ranking of a major revenue source, and with this change, the issue of compression and the determination of local rates will be scrutinized, I think, more thoroughly. Policy questions, I think, have been already discussed very briefly before I did my presentation. And they address a lot of things about the constitutional limits and whether or not those limits that were adopted for very good reasons, perhaps in 05 and 97-98, in order to ensure that taxes would be used for specific purposes, that they would not become excessive, might not have envisioned the interdependence among the code area, among the taxing districts within the code areas, may not have envisioned how much compression could limit situations, had not envisioned that real market value could decline or be flat relative to assessed value. And so there are issues that could be addressed or reviewed, again, as policy considerations. And then, of course, the federal funding issue, as you pointed out, Senator Monroe, is an emergency state issue because of its obligation to the counties. And I think that's all I have to say. I was going to introduce Gilvin to give you more detail, but I think he's already given you all.
Well, I know you would do a better job of introducing Gil than the very brief and probably not full introduction that I gave him, but no, this is good. This is good. We got a discussion of one issue affecting local cities and counties, and then a good overview. Senator Monroe, do you have any questions?
Yes. Is it fair to say that those districts that are going to lose the most of this federal timber money tend to have lower aggregate property tax rates?
Yes.
It seemed like that's a relationship there, since they've been relying on these timber receipts. They didn't have to vote to raise their property taxes as high. And now, of course, with property tax limitation measures, especially the double majority measure, it becomes very, very difficult for them to, even if they wanted to backfill with property taxes what they have lost or are losing in timber tax receipts.
That is correct. I mean, just consider the geographic issue, too. There's all this land that is dedicated to, that belongs to the federal government. They can't grow it. They can't do anything with it. And so their urban growth boundaries can't be expanded to support more right. services. So it's a constraint on them.
We got our hands full, boss.
Yeah, we do. Thank you very much, Mary. Tomorrow we have the governor's office, and so we're going to meet with the House. And whenever we do this, the House is well represented. All their members show up, and usually, so as many senators as we can get there, we're usually well out.
More of them, too.
They got more of them, and they're all there, and so... Tomorrow, I know you'll be here. We need to cajole our other members so it's not 2-on-10 tomorrow for the governor's presentation on his budget and finance. With that, then I think we're going to try to get the income discussion, income and corporate one, scheduled for Monday, but we'll post that probably this afternoon. We are adjourned.